You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferry. Coming up, a report from the White House calls on Congress to take legislative action to support Native American voting rights. We'll look at some of the unique challenges facing Native American voters around the country. Now at a Milwaukee Bucks game, if you want music to get you pumped up, who are you going to call? Giannis Antetokounmpo knows.
Who's your favorite DJ, Giannis?
Oh, you. DJ Sun, by far. Not even close. She was in the All-Star game. All the best players in the world. She was right there, DJ. That's how you know she's the best.
Shauna Nichols, also known as DJ Shauna, is the official DJ and producer for the Milwaukee Bucks. She recently DJed for the NCAA Women's Final Four basketball tournament, as well as for the NBA All-Star Game and the Ryder Cup. Shauna previously opened for Lizzo at Summerfest and played basketball at UW-Madison. I talked to her earlier this week about what it means to be a major sports DJ. Well, can you tell us about your job as DJ and producer for the Bucks? What goes into that and how much fun is it?
So much fun. It's hard to put it into a concise sort of brief synopsis for you, though, on what goes into it. But we'll simplify it to game days. So as soon as you walk into Fiserv, we've got music pumping. My job has started long before that, actually. So I've already probably been in the building for maybe four and a half hours in meetings, making sure we're ready for the game. I've already prepped a couple hours pregame for everything that we're going to do in the show, and I'm already DJing for the Milwaukee Bucks that are out on the court doing their pregame warm-ups before fans even enter the building. But when you scan your ticket and enter the building, the hopes is that it's a party vibe, that you're there, you know, it's a basketball game, especially with playoffs coming up now, being the defending champions. The energy is just contagious, and once the ball gets tipped, to be honest, everything that you hear audio wise that's not a video really is coming from me. So I'm pushing some buttons, turning some knobs, and just really constantly, we just don't stop at Fiserv.
As you're planning a set list for a night, what is different about a sports event like a Bucks game, for example, versus a club or a party?
Totally different. It's a different experience. And so the demographic that especially in Milwaukee, is so diverse. It's one of my favorite things about being the Bucks DJ, especially being in the Deer District last playoffs and finals. When you look out there, like, that's the Milwaukee that I love. That's the Milwaukee that I love to be a part of. And so imagine trying to make 100,000 people happy who aren't there for you as a show. They're there to support the Milwaukee Bucks. And so it's a tricky little game that you have to try to play between every sort of type of music, really, for every single person out there. And so it's very different from a club or a bar or a festival set, candidly, that I've done. And where club, bar, festival set, that's like your show, you know, like that's about me. But when I've been an athlete my whole life, and so when I am going to a Bucks game, I'm a part of a team, and I'm a part of something that's bigger than me. And this isn't my show, and it's not about me. It's not about the songs that I want to play or I want to hear. This is not only about the guys that are in uniform on the court, but this is about Milwaukee, and this is about something way bigger than me. So a lot of those nerdy things that I think about kind of go into that.
All right, now you're the perfect person to ask a dumb question I wonder when I'm in the stands, you know, at a sporting event, and the athletes are down there, and there's a song that's getting me pumped up, and I'm thinking, is it getting the players pumped up, or have they just tuned everything out? Now, you've been on the court. You played for the UW-Madison women's basketball team, and you're a DJ now. Like, do you, when you're on the court, do you hear what the DJ is doing? Do you hear what's playing in the arena?
I'm old enough to where we didn't have a DJ. And so my job actually didn't exist when I was playing at Wisconsin as a Badger and even overseas as a professional. And so my job wasn't even around. So that's something that is just like enamors me, is I get into the arena and I'm like, this is just so crazy, like knowing both sides of the game and soaking it all in. But from what I have gathered, it's not about the music. Pre-game, I think a little bit, like they hear it there. It's more about what the music does to the people that are in the arena there to support the guys. That's the energy that is felt. So this, I think, this really cool symbiotic relationship where we all need each other to be successful NBA champions.
Now we're headed into the NBA playoffs. At last year's finals, you got a chance to spin your own record. I want to listen to a clip of the track. It's called
Thank
I Won't
you.
Give Up. It features the artist Tanner Howe.
Give up, oh, oh, oh.
you.
Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to craft this tune?
Oh, Rob, that brings tears to my eyes every time I get to hear that. I'm sorry. Like, I'm very sincere. It's very surreal. So Tanner, whose vocals you heard on there, we went through this project during the pandemic, and we never met. Actually, everything we did was over the computer. Tanner is an incredible singer-songwriter out in LA, and he and I share the same management, and that's how this kind of happened. Is I want to start putting more of my own music out there, more of like stuff like that that hopefully makes people bob their heads and smile and inspires and gives them hope. So honestly, like, without sounding too cheesy, that was written during the pandemic, and I was sitting right here where I am right now talking to you, having a conversation again face to face with Tanner over a computer, and saying like, I want to write this for people who, like, I want to hit as many things as we possibly can. So like, for me, I think I like to hustle, and I like to set goals and have these dreams and aspirations that seem so absurd and unreachable, and just work my butt off in silence and do it and then move on to the next thing. And I was like, but I also want to write it because we're also in the middle of a pandemic, and this is like really, really hard. And I miss my family, and there's people that I can't see. And we're also going through one of the biggest social justice movements in our lifetime. That is just so important to remind people that Black Lives Matter. And I want everybody to feel this. I want this to be, maybe somebody feels this in a relationship. Maybe somebody feels this when they look in the mirror, when they're brushing their teeth in the morning. And so honestly, that's a lot of different people, but I wanted it to hit home. And I wrote it for you. I wrote it for people that, you know, want to make the world a little bit of a better place in their own way.
And DJ Shauna, the defending champion Milwaukee Bucks, start playoffs this weekend against the Bulls. What are you doing to get ready?
Man, I'm sleeping. but I'm already ready. I mean, that was the coolest thing. Like yesterday for me, I had just Sunday, I had gotten back. I got to work the women's U.S. national soccer game in Columbus.
Nice.
Friendly game against Uzbekistan. And so I got back and had brunch with my family, took a nap, and then I was all day just watching to see what was going to play out, especially in the Eastern Conference, and to see, you know, where we were going to fall, who we get to play. And I'm just excited. And I think I read some stuff on Twitter from the Bucks squad, and coach walked out of the press room, and he, you know, publicly very rarely raises his voice, and he yelled, "It's playoffs, baby." And that's like the vibe. It's like, all right, let's go. Like, this is it.
All right. Well, have a great series, Shauna. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all very much. I hope you have a great spring. Stay healthy, and Bucks in six.
That was Shauna Nichols, also known as DJ Shauna, the official DJ and producer for the Milwaukee Bucks. She joined me just after her DJing duties for the NCAA Women's Final Four basketball tournament and a U.S. Women's National Soccer Team friendly, talking about her work for the Bucks. I spoke to her earlier this week. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a mother's tea.
Many of us grew up questioning our parents' methods and traditions, only to find ourselves embracing them later in life. That was definitely the case for writer Yeo Lor. She tells us about the skepticism and love of her mother's tea.
When I would get sick, my mother would rummage through the cabinets, pulling out crinkled Ziploc bags filled with twisted roots that once clung to the earth, golden leaves touched by King Midas, and of course, the trusty old Chopa Jay. The Chopa Jay was our family's medicine rock. This white, clay-like crystal my mother would scrape into a powder before boiling it into a tasteless tea. Then she'd order me to drink and ask no questions. I had many. I drank anyway. My mother comes from a long line of healers. Her father was a shaman who traveled between both worlds. She is an herbalist who interprets dreams. I happen to be the skeptic of all things. When I was 8, I lost one of my front teeth. Months went by and still no tooth. How did you throw it away? My mother asked, because you see, there's a special way of disposing of one's tooth. If you lose a tooth along the top, you must hold the tooth up to your forehead and let it fall into the garbage. Our teeth at the top grow down, so the tooth must also go down. My mother did not witness how I had thrown the tooth away and became concerned. One day she said, "When we go to the garden, bring an apple." Across our garden was a grassy field, and in that field lived a horse. I was instructed to offer the apple to the horse and say, Horsey, horsey, my tooth will not grow back. May I have one of your teeth, please? Shortly after that, it grew back. I remained a skeptic. I was embarrassed by my mother's unconventional ways. Many times I demanded to see the label of her ingredients. My mother said her chua didn't come with labels. She would say, "Bei Meng Hu Li Na, we Hmong call it this." And this never seemed to have a good translation. For example, chua gu ta hao literally means medicine hot head. When you Google it, it pulls up hot flashes and menopause, which I don't think I was experiencing at 15. I refused to drink my mother's chua from then on. The following 10 years, I did what most everybody does. I went to the doctor. Sometimes I was told to go home and let things heal on their own, take some Advil, apply this cream, here some antibiotics. Something was always missing, though. I started to explore how others heal themselves and became fascinated with rocks, these everyday things that could be a billion years old. Imagine the stories they must hold. I wondered if that was what my mother thought when she untangled roots or collected leaves for another herbal concoction. During my rock phase, I learned about selenite, known as a healing stone. It's sometimes sold in thin, long slabs. I ordered one for myself, and when it arrived, I noticed it was soft, a bit dull, and somewhat chalky. That's when I realized I had seen this before, in my mother's kitchen. The trusty old chopaje, the tasteless tea I drank as a child, this was it, just in a different form. I was babysitting my nephew when he lost a tooth. He wanted to put it under his pillow for some tooth fairy money. "Bud," I said, "do you want tooth fairy money, or do you want your tooth to grow back?" There we stood in front of the garbage bin. Sometimes the universe has its way of leading you back to your mother's tea.
That story came to us from Yia Lore, a writer who lives in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn more about a report released by the White House last month that highlights the disparities Native Americans still face when trying to vote. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House released a report this past March on Native American voting rights. The report called on Congress to pass legislation that would increase voting accessibility. It cited multiple barriers that some Native Americans face when trying to vote, including language barriers, cultural disrespect, and outright hostility, among others. The report comes a year after President Biden issued an executive order on promoting access to voting, which included the creation of the Interagency Steering Group on Native American Voting Rights. Over the last year, the steering group met with tribal leaders and Native Americans around the country. This report is a result of those meetings. Jacqueline De Leon is an enrolled member of the Isleta Pueblo and a staff attorney for the Native American Rights Fund. Jacqueline, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about some of the unique barriers and obstacles that Native Americans still face after, in many cases, decades of legal challenges? What are some of the biggest problems out there still today?
Sure. So I kind of think of this in two different buckets. The first bucket is the structural problems that Native Americans face across this country. Often, it's no surprise to folks that Native American reservations are remote. They're a little bit more rural. But what we're seeing is that those homes on the reservations often lack addresses. They lack access to residential mail delivery, even lacking access to residential mail delivery relative to other rural Americans. And they have poor road conditions and unfortunately, poverty. And all of those conditions make things like travel to a polling place especially hard and make voting by mail sometimes virtually impossible. And so those are sort of the structural barriers that plague Native communities that make it just technically difficult to vote. And then I think the second bucket, which you alluded to in your intro, is unfortunately we see hostility from local county poll workers, clerks, and states across the country towards Native American access, a refusal to put on reservation polling places or registration opportunities, and a refusal to have Native American poll workers, and some outright disrespectful moves, like in South Dakota, where they insisted that Native Americans vote out of a repurposed chicken coop. So unfortunately, what we see is active discrimination against Native Americans that I think would be surprising to most Americans.
On the structural side of things, you mentioned reservations, addresses might work differently in ways that election officials or election laws in particular state might not recognize. What do you hope to see when it comes to solutions for that?
Sure. So there's a federal bill right now, the Native American Voting Rights Act, and that bill is actually bipartisan in both the House and the Senate. And what it does is it recognizes that tribes' homes across the country are not addressed, and often there's severe overcrowding. So people are moving from home to home, so may not have a permanent address, a lot of couch surfing. And as a result, what NAVRA does is it allows a tribe to designate a building on the reservation that can be used to register, pick up, drop off a ballot. So just allowing folks to overcome that structural barrier. Additionally, we're hoping for an increased attention by the Postal Service and increased funding in President Biden's recent budget proposal included a lot of funding for the Postal Service to increase service in underserved areas like reservations.
On the hostility side of things, some of those examples you gave of just outright, cultural hostility toward Native Americans as they engage with the voting process, in some ways that seems like a harder problem to solve. What do you do to tackle that?
Absolutely. So I think the problem is when you think about Native American communities, often the legacy is one of folks that there's a colonized community, and then there's, the descendants of colonizers. And that's a really close interaction, and there's a historical legacy of racism and hostility that occurs. And so elections are often run by local officials at that county level. And regardless of sort of larger political affiliations or trends of a state, what you see at the local level is just longstanding prejudices. And so what I think we have to do is mandate that on-reservation access to registration, early voting, election day polling places take place. And that's something that NAVRA does. So it takes the discretion away from those local county officials who are refusing to provide on-reservation access.
We've got these two different kinds of obstacles, as you've laid it out, structural ones, things like the unrecognized addresses, the cultural ones as well. How much of an impact does this have on Native American voters' ability to vote?
Well, unfortunately, Native Americans have the largest discrepancy between eligible voters, percentage-wise, eligible voters and voters that cast a ballot. We have a really large unregistered population and a really low turnout rates in some areas. So these barriers are absolutely impacting the Native vote and unfairly, I think.
What we're talking about is happening at the federal level, this Native American Voting Rights Act. Are there things you're hoping that states do to maybe meet the needs of what might be a unique situation? What might be one thing here in Wisconsin, might be another, say, in Alaska?
Yeah, so I mean, I think every state should look at every constituent and recognize their value and accommodate the realities of their lives. And we've seen some states take action. For example, Washington State passed its own Native American Voting Rights Act that allowed tribes to do this designating of a building. And we've seen other states make moves to pass their own Native American Voting Rights Act to sort of recognize that their state may have structural problems and then allow litigation to address that. And in all instances, I think all states should recognize tribal IDs and not require an address on those tribal IDs in order to vote.
I mentioned that interagency steering group on Native American voting rights. It sounds like at least the goal was to have a lot of voices at the table. Do you think that on the process side of things, that was successful, that the right people weighed in on some of these issues?
Well, I do think it was a really powerful report. As you say, you know, I think there was a lot of input and outlining of actual discrimination of the different types of barriers that exist. And so I think it was a pretty good deep dive. I will also say, you know, NARF has also done a similar report. We held a series of 9 field hearings across Indian country. And we have an almost 200-page report, Obstacles at Every Turn, Barriers to Political Participation Faced by Native Americans, at vote.narf.org.
In just our last half a minute or so, Jacqueline, do you think it's likely that some version of this Native American Voting Rights Act will pass anytime soon?
You know, at the end of the day, NAVRA is bipartisan in both the House and the Senate. I think most Americans recognize that everybody deserves at least a fair shot and at voting. And so I think that this legislation is distinct. The federal government also has an obligation towards Native Americans that's different than other Americans. There's a federal trust relationship, so they have a lot more leeway to pass voting rights laws. And I definitely think they should, and I definitely think that they can.
Jacqueline, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jacqueline De Leon, an enrolled member of the Isleta Pueblo and a staff attorney with the Native American Rights Fund. She joined us for a look at the obstacles facing Native American voters and a bill in Congress aimed at tackling at least some of those obstacles. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, where'd the empathy go? A guest makes the case that tough times call for more understanding, but we're not really seeing it. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we learn more about the Biden administration's efforts to regulate home-built firearms and gun kits, sometimes known as ghost guns. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at Democratic and Republican bills that have the goal of making childcare more affordable. First on Monday, President Biden announced new federal regulations on privately assembled firearms. Sometimes called ghost guns, they don't have serial numbers and they're basically impossible to trace. Police around the country have reported seizing more and more of them from criminal use. The new rules aim to regulate home-built guns in similar ways to commercially sold firearms in an effort to cut back on black market distribution. We're learning more about the rise of ghost guns and what impact the new regulations could have. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these gun kits, these so-called ghost guns? Are you glad to see the Biden administration trying to regulate them? Do you think the regulations went too far or not far enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alex McCourt is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. He also works in the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As I understand it, Alex, these so-called ghost guns can come in a lot of different forms, different kinds of kits. Could you give us a broad stroke definition of what these things are and how they work?
Sure. So these guns are generally guns that lack serial numbers. This is distinct from the type of gun that is a traditionally manufactured gun that lacks a serial number because it's been obliterated. So these are guns that lack serial numbers by design. They could be constructed from individual parts. Those parts might be purchased separately, or they might be purchased as part of a kit, or they might be 3D printed. And those are the primary ways that these guns are made.
How common are these things? How available are these things now?
So we don't have very good data on this. It's very difficult to track gun ownership and use in general. And that's even more true for these guns that are, by definition, untraceable. What we do know from both federal data, federal reports and law enforcement data is that use of these guns seems to be increasing. And that could be because they're very available. It's very easy to order these online, and really anybody is able to do it.
How easy are these to assemble? I've heard it's not like snapping together a Lego kit, but it's easier than, you know, building a firearm from raw materials.
Yeah, that's about right. It's not as simple as Legos or really probably many different hobbies, but it is pretty straightforward. There are some that advertise being able to be constructed in 30 minutes or less. But really, even if it takes several hours or a day, that's pretty quick to be able to go from having just the component parts to having a functioning firearm.
So here we have the Biden administration looking to have these new regulations. Here's a clip from his announcement back on Monday.
All of a sudden, it's no longer a ghost. It has a return address. It's going to help save lives, reduce crime, and get more criminals off the streets.
What in these new requirements would require that kind of return address, that equivalent of a serial number that would be on a firearm that you would traditionally buy?
So what this rule would do is bring these guns in line with your traditional gun. So traditionally, when a gun is recovered by law enforcement, it has a serial number and some other markings on it. And law enforcement and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, can use that information to figure out who the manufacturer is and trace it from there. Where did it go for retail sale? And from there, who was it sold to? And the goal, obviously, is to get to the person that ultimately used the gun in crime. Right now, these guns are untraceable, these ghost guns or these privately made firearms. What this rule would do is require that these kits or these individual parts have serial numbers on them. That would mean that when a gun that was made from a kit was recovered by law enforcement, it would be traceable.
Now, I could see a various group of people being interested in this. One, maybe just a firearms, a home hobbyist who, you know, like some people like to build computers for kits. They think, yeah, I'd like to make my own gun from a kit. All the way over to people who want untraceable guns for very specific criminal reasons. Do we know much about the market and who's buying these things?
We don't know very much about it. We do know that there have been very high profile uses of these guns and these kits in gun trafficking and also in some mass shootings, including school shootings. There have also been individuals that told law enforcement that they specifically sought out these guns because they had no other way of accessing guns because they were prohibited from buying a traditional gun. However, there are some people who just like to build guns at home and they like to engage in that as a hobby. Importantly, the rule that was put out is really clear that this doesn't do anything to stop you from making your own gun at home. It has more to do with the serial numbers that are on these specific kits and who can sell those and manufacture them and what licensed dealers and licensed manufacturers can do with those. So there's still nothing stopping someone from building their own gun for personal use.
We're talking to Alex McCord from Johns Hopkins University with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions, looking at these gun kits that allow people to build guns at home, of various paths to get there, as we've heard. New regulations from the Biden administration aim to treat them more like existing commercially sold guns, including requiring identifying serial numbers. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe if you've made one of these, ordered one of these yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Hans is with us in Kaukauna. Hans, hello.
Hello. I wanted to mention that criminals are criminals by definition. They're already breaking the law. All those who do it make criminals of people who are often will make criminals of people who are not criminals, restrict the rights of people. And the thing about it, I just don't see where it's going to help anything prevent crimes because bad people are going to do bad things. We really have to go after the motivation of the criminals, go after. We're not even forcing the laws we have in place. It's another law that's going to be restrictive to good people.
Well, Hans, I want to get your thought on this. The idea, at least the argument from the Biden administration, is this is taking the existing laws that apply to something you might buy, like at a traditional firearm store, and just applying it to this kind of new science fiction category of guns. Do you think that's okay, or do you worry about that?
Well, part of the reason that some people I know have built these things is because as soon as there is a serial number on it that has to be registered through a federal firearms license dealer, that gives a place for people to confiscate, for the government to confiscate the firearms of the people. Many people that I know in the culture want these to prevent confiscation of their firearms, because part of the reason people have firearms is to protect from both domestic and foreign enemies. And that's a true thing. And a domestic enemy can be our own government if they become, even Donald Trump. I said, who's going to protect your First Amendment rights if you don't have your Second Amendment rights in place?
Hans, thanks for the call. Alex, I think Hans pointing toward a motivation, as he said, from people, the culture he was referring to there, wanting non-traceable guns to prevent government confiscation. What do you think of that argument?
I think it's really fascinating, and it's not a it's an important argument to consider. I think it's also incredibly common that when the ATF put out its proposed rule, it got hundreds of thousands of responses, and many of them were very similar to what Hans said. There's this concern that this will make criminals out of people that are law-abiding citizens, and it will affect their right to have a gun in the home for self-defense. Importantly, I think there's this idea of criminals that criminals will be criminals and they'll be able to access guns. But what we're seeing is actually many law enforcement agencies that are reporting increases in these guns are in states that have particularly strong gun laws. And these gun laws, like purchaser licensing and extreme risk protection orders, make it more difficult to get a gun for someone who is at high risk of harming themselves or others. So maybe that's somebody who has a criminal history, or maybe it's just someone who is at risk of self-harm. But when they're not able to access a gun, they are able to access these kits. There's no background check requirements, and the prohibitions at the federal and state level don't kick in for these kits. As a result, we see people who have violent felony convictions, domestic violence convictions, and even children that are able to get these kits and construct guns.
Hans, thanks for that call. We're talking about so-called ghost guns, these home gun construction kits, and new Biden administration regulations with Johns Hopkins University public health professor Alex McCourt. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this concept new to you? Do you have questions about how it works? Or are you very familiar with it? Have you ordered and assembled one of these firearms at home yourself? What do you think of the idea of regulating them, requiring serial numbers on these homemade guns or home assembled guns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Professor Alex McCourt from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention, with us today to talk about home-built firearms, known as ghost guns by some, as the Biden administration starts implementing new regulations requiring them to have serial numbers, among other things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about these home gun kits? Are you worried about them, or do you think they're a good idea? What do you think about the idea of regulating them a little more like existing firearms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go back to your calls now with James in Fall Creek. Hey, James.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, James?
Well, there's a couple of points that should be brought out, and I'm speaking for the state of Wisconsin. In the past, there have been many, many, many guns that without serial numbers that were produced. They were standard shotguns, Winchester Model 37, for example. All of the Stevens guns, they didn't have serial numbers. And then on top of that, in Wisconsin at least, where we have the right to transfer a gun to a private individual, or to a private individual, there is no actual tracing of serial numbers. If you go to a gun show in Wisconsin, you can purchase a gun. It may have a serial number, but that gun is not tracked.
Got it. And James, thanks for the call. Alex, James pointing toward some gaps in serial number and serial number tracking with existing guns. Forget, you know, even setting aside the so-called ghost guns for the moment.
Yeah, James is absolutely right that there are many private sales where serial numbers are not tracked. And so this is often a stumbling block for law enforcement, but also arguably a protection for some individuals who like to privately transfer their guns and are not dealing with federally licensed dealers. And this rule would not change that. So if somebody made a gun from a kit that had a serial number on it and then transferred it in a private transfer, as long as they're in a state that does not regulate those private transfers, that is just like a traditional gun. So these are not special rules for privately made guns, but are rather just bringing them in line with all other guns.
James, thanks for that call. We got an email from Matt in Madison who says, one of the reasons they caught the shooter in New York City so quick is because they could trace the purchase to a 2011 purchase, the firearm. The fact that ghost guns even exist is a testimonial, he says, to the right's dismissal of any gun management. I will say I'm following this story in the news just like everybody else. Alex, I don't know the exact details of what led to the apprehension there, but the traceability of the firearm used, I know that is part of the story here.
Yeah, I'm in a similar position that I don't know the details, but I had heard that it was a gun that was not a ghost gun that had a serial number. And I think when guns are recovered that have serial numbers, it can be an important tool for law enforcement to try to investigate who was behind an act of violence. And it can also help identify individuals who were involved in straw purchases and gun trafficking.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is on the line in Monona. Hi, Nate.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I see no reason not to have serial numbers on every gun that's produced. The majority of people who are doing that are people who are trying to avoid the law. Those people are a threat to everybody in society. So there's, all these arguments are bogus. Somebody who wants to make guns, they can make guns regardless of whether they got a serial number or not. The argument about Stevens guns, those are old antique guns. I don't even know if Stevens is still manufacturing guns.
I gotcha, Nate. Thanks for the call. Nate, seeing the main purpose of these non-serial numbered ghost guns, Alex, being for people with bad intent. As you say, we don't necessarily have the numbers on that, but there is that concern.
Absolutely, there is that concern. And because we don't have data, it's difficult to say whether that is the primary motivation for purchasing these kits or manufacturing these guns. But it certainly makes a lot of sense that individuals who want to get a gun and want to make sure that nobody knows they have it and that it can't be traced if they lose it or discard it after using it in a crime, these guns are appealing for those individuals.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to Alex McCord from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention, looking at home gun kits, gun making kits, sometimes called ghost guns, new Biden administration regulations, trying to give them the similar serial numbers to firearms you might buy at a gun store. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is on the line now in Delavan. Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, hi. I'll stay right up front. I have no understanding of how people with the frontier mentality of the right to own guns with no restrictions or registration, how they justify that, because the concern of this mass federal task force going door to door, taking guns when we're losing 45,000 people a year due to guns. So that's nearly 500,000 in 10 years. I just don't understand how that equates. That's my only comment.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Alex, can you talk about the toll of gun violence? And Kathleen doesn't seem to worry about door-to-door gun confiscations being likely.
Yeah, gun violence is a massive problem, especially in the United States. Compared to peer nations, the U.S. has a disproportionate rate of firearm violence. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen big increases in firearm homicide. And I think it's really important in this conversation when we're talking about these guns to again underscore that they undermine a lot of the kind of policy solutions that we have put in place in certain states that try to reduce gun violence and try to keep guns away from those at high risk of harming themselves or others. In terms of going door to door and taking guns, that is a common fear among some gun owners. There are protections in place, however, laws that prohibit the creation of a federal registry of guns. So there's no indication that would ever happen. And in fact, there is a Second Amendment right to own a handgun in the home for self-defense, provided you're not prohibited from possessing.
Thanks for that call. John joins us now in Madison. John, hi.
Yeah, I used to own a gun. I sold it. I think guns are very good for hunting. You want to carry a sidearm with you. You wound an animal and it's you're hunting, you shoot it. I think really what comes down to is the gun manufacturers want to scare people into buying guns. They give millions of dollars to politicians to help them support. If they don't sell guns, they're out of business. They want to scare people to buy guns, and politicians help them scare people.
John, thanks for the call. What do you think, Alex?
You know, it's interesting. There is some research that has shown that in times of high stress or high, kind of fear in society, purchases of guns increase. And we actually saw record-breaking gun purchases during the first year in 2020 of the COVID-19 pandemic, as people were feeling less safe, less sure about everything. And many of those purchases were first-time gun owners who felt the need to go buy a gun. So there is something to be said for fear being a driver of gun ownership.
Thanks for that call. Alex, in our last minute or so, we have these regulations announced. There is a process. When would these come into effect? And when do you see them starting to be enforced? Or is there likely to be a big legal challenge? We might not see this in place for a while.
So the rule should go into effect in about 120 days. So about 4 months, we'll see it go into effect. That said, there will almost certainly be a legal challenge that legal challenge could originate in many different areas. It could be a constitutional challenge. It also could be a challenge to ATF's authority. Experts, I think, generally agree that there is not a very firm basis for many of those legal challenges, but we are certainly going to see them. But provided there is no holdup in the courts, this regulation should go into effect this in about 4 months.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alex McCourt works in the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions and is an assistant professor in the Department of Health, Policy, and Management. He joined us for a look at these so-called ghost guns, guns that can be made or assembled from kits, and new proposed regulations announced this week by the Biden administration that would treat them like commercially available firearms, especially as regards identifiable serial numbers. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, a lot of Americans are struggling with the costs of childcare. Republicans in Congress have one plan. Democrats have another. There is some overlap, too. We'll sort it out and find out what the child care situation looks like here in Wisconsin. And you can tell us what might help you and your family. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.